You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on urinary tract infections, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Lenore Ackerman, Associate Professor of Urology and the Director of Research in the Division of Urogynecology and Reconstructive Pelvic Surgery at the University of California, Los Angeles. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for use healthcare professionals.
Hello, I'm Dr. Lenore Ackerman. Welcome to the Medscape In Discussion podcast series on urinary tract infections. Today, we're focusing on recurrent UTIs in older women and its association with genitourinary syndrome of menopause. First, let me introduce my guest, Dr. Melissa Kaufman. Dr. Melissa Kaufman is professor of urology and chief of the Division of Reconstructive Urology in Pelvic Health at Vanderbilt Medical Center, where she also holds the Patricia and Rhodes Hart Endowed Chair of Urologic Surgery. Welcome to the Medscape In Discussion Urinary Tract Infection podcast. And it is so great to see you. I have a number of things that I want to discuss with you today that particularly focus on UTIs in older women. So let me start off by asking, when you see a woman with recurrent UTIs, particularly an older woman, how do you evaluate the patient clinically?
Well, I really appreciate that kind introduction, Dr. Ackerman. And additionally, before we begin, I want to thank our podcast audience for their engagement and interest in the topic of treatment of recurrent urinary tract infections and the genitourinary syndrome of menopause, which really represents an incredibly impactful condition to both the individuals that are affected and our entire healthcare system. Now, to your question about how I evaluate a patient clinically that comes in with recurrent UTIs, I want to set some context for the discussion and remind everyone on the podcast that really our guidelines for recurrent urinary tract infection are regarding an index patient population. And these are women with localized cystitis that is really restricted to the lower urinary tract. Patients who have complicating anatomic or functional factors and systemic involvement are really managed differently. And although there can be tremendous overlap in strategies, it's really not the primary target for our guidelines. And additionally, there are multiple definitions of what a recurrent urinary tract infection really means. And the guideline supports the most commonly utilized definition of two episodes of bacterial cystitis within a six-month period within the preceding year. We're going to discuss in greater detail a little later diagnostic strategies to determine the presence of urinary tract infection, but acute cystitis really implies that the patient's coming to you with new onset symptoms like dysuria, which is really central to the diagnosis, and in conjunction with some variable degrees of storage symptoms such as urgency, frequency, even hematuria or new or worsening incontinence. So with regards to the evaluation, it's of course always a clinical principle, perform a history. And the history is focused on the patient's urinary symptoms associated with the UTI. Details of things like prior surgical interventions, baseline genitourinary symptoms, and even bowel symptoms can really be useful in discerning what is a urinary tract infection versus what is some other comorbid or confounding condition. Symptoms the patient considers related to a urinary tract infection and their relationship to other triggers, as well as treatments that have been previously prescribed, are necessary to elicit. And it's always recommended that initial presentation includes a pelvic exam, because this exam can be incredibly helpful to determine other conditions which may be significant contributors, like vaginal atrophy from genitourinary syndrome of menopause that we'll discuss in a little bit more depth later, a urethral diverticulum, or pelvic organ prolapse. But one of the primary modifications of our latest guideline amendment is how we're to think of urinary tract infection and symptomatic acute cystitis with regards to diagnosis. There's a very significant negative predictive value for a negative urinalysis, meaning you obtain a urinalysis and it doesn't have nitrites, it doesn't have white cells, And that may be very useful at ruling out acute cystitis. It also thoughtfully addresses the fact that contamination of clean catch urine specimens with skin and vaginal bacteria is very common and can result in high rates of suboptimal or really unnecessary treatments. If there's ever a question, obtain a catheterized specimen for the most accurate sampling. And when we evaluate the urinalysis, we should document not just the presence of the bacteria and uropathogenic bacteria, but also document inflammation or pyuria, which is more than 5 white blood cells per high-powered field on the microscopic urinalysis. You know, that diagnostic threshold for colony counts is a topic of debate. But what's also a topic of debate is other potential concomitant urologic pathologies that come in when patients present with these symptoms. So a lot of patients will have what we term asymptomatic bacteriuria, and they will have lower urinary tract symptoms and storage symptoms, and it's very difficult to delineate what is an active UTI. So we're always thinking about, is this really bacterial cystitis, or is it interstitial cystitis, bladder pain syndrome, pelvic floor myofascial pain, or overactive bladder, all of which can mimic UTI and really confound the diagnosis. So I think the keys are a urinalysis demonstrating pyuria, a history that demonstrates symptoms, and a pelvic exam to rule out other causes.
That's, I think, a really important point. So when we see women with presumptive infections, I think there's a lot of fear about not treating them with antibiotics. But given all of the potential for misdiagnosis and also for the consequences of antibiotics, what have we kind of learned in recent years about when to use antibiotics and what really constitutes overuse of antibiotics?
That's a really insightful question because, unfortunately, you know, even a positive urinalysis with nitrites and leukocytes may indicate what we now appreciate as really normal commensal complement of bacteria to the bladder. We typically assign dysuria as a primary symptom, but it's not always reflected in every individual, and especially those that may have some alteration of sensory abilities, sometimes just our older population. And using that 10 to the fifth coliforming units and culture is rooted in some degree of really an arbitrary historical cutoff, because sometimes much lower colony counts reflect a more realistic approach. And it depends also how they're sampled. So the idea is that everyone is bacteriuric, and these symbiotic commensals are really likely critical for a really broad range of our lower urinary tract function. You know, one of the things that has emerged is a lot of advanced molecular technologies. And they've provided us a more complete characterization of all these genitourinary microbes. We have PCR, we have next generation sequencing. These diagnostic tests have really enticing preliminary studies suggesting that their utilization may facilitate equivalent or even better clinical outcomes than standard urine cultures because they decrease the time to diagnosis. And the idea and the hope is that they would reduce empiric antibiotic prescription. However, there's a lot of really clinically insignificant data. And we have to acknowledge that although there's a genetic material that's revealed, it doesn't mean that it implies a phenotype of expression for that gene. It doesn't mean that it is going to determine resistance or sensitivity to antibiotics. So all these rapid diagnostics really remain a question. And the answer is really not just improving this antimicrobial stewardship by improving our testing, but by improving our judgment, because this resistance pattern has increased dramatically for uropathogens over the past 20 years. So really, to directly answer your question, overdiagnosis of bacteria in the urine is what's leading us to overtreatment with antibiotics. And this has some very grave consequences on both the individual and at a societal level.
So given now that we understand that there is a urobiome or these commensal microbes that live with us and may be in the urinary tract with us. How should we internalize this information to influence how we manage recurrent urinary tract infections?
Well, really, as our conceptualization of this urinary microbiome evolves, we understand this is not a sterile environment. There are a number of symbiotic bacteria that are part of our normal physiology. And overutilization of antimicrobials can lead to a systemic dysbiosis. So really, it's a disruption of a careful homeostasis. And the collateral damage from this rampant overuse of antibiotics has really far-reaching consequences outside of our entire microbiome. I mean, as clinicians, we often focus on Clostridium difficile infections and the development of resistance in organisms. But I actually believe that we need to have a much broader perspective when we think about our urobiome. E. coli is really the perfect example of what I would term a pathobiont, which is an organism that is so critical to human development. And it only manifests as disease during states of dysbiosis or imbalance. E. coli and the E. coli that we know as a uropathogen is actually a homeostatic mechanism in our gut. It's critical during childhood for development of mucosal immunity. So there's something else that's causing disruption. Maybe it's not really just microplastics that are in our water supply, but overuse of antibiotics that's destroying this really delicate balance of commensals and fueling, I believe, potentially the extraordinary rise of other types of disease processes, like the multiple types of cancer that we're seeing in young people. So the goal would be a really substantial decrease in overall antimicrobial use to decrease the selective pressure on our partners in developing our mucosal immunity, our partners in our gut. So repopulation of this native urobiome with technologies maybe like fecal transplant may be in the future. So for a clinician, first, resist treating asymptomatic bacteriuria. You know, when patients present with acute cystitis and a history of UTIs, many providers employ strategies like lengthening the course of antibiotics, broadening treatment, increasing doses, but there's really no evidence for those practices. And patients expect some type of treatment, and they may pressure a provider to give non-guideline-based treatments because it may have worked for them previously, and that they have a hope that it will reduce the number of recurrent episodes. But these strategies really have not been demonstrated to be efficacious, and they have potential for harm and directly contradict our principles of antibiotic stewardship.
So I'm hearing a lot of evidence, I think, against the idea of using antibiotics just indiscriminately for the management of UTIs, and particularly when we get into the world of prevention, a prophylaxis of UTIs. Are there other options then for how to manage patients with recurrent UTIs that don't rely on antibiotics?
Yeah, and it's really been due to the growing concern regarding antibiotic overutilization and resistance that our recurrent UTI guidelines address optimization of non-antibiotic prophylaxis. One of the biggest ones really is water intake. It's actually written into the guidelines, and there's relatively good data that suggests that this is a very low risk and effective method to reduce the risk of UTI. So I encourage women for hydration of a liter and a half of water. Now, granted, if you additionally have a patient that has comorbid overactive bladder, that can be pretty challenging. But overall, conservative measures that temporize symptoms to allow a natural clearance is a reasonable strategy. And there are other types of prophylactic measures. Let me preface this by saying that some of them, like cranberry and D-mannose, I'd just like to explain to the audience why they may be theoretically effective against common uropathic E. coli. So E. coli binds to human cells by projections on the bacterial cell surface called fimbriae. And the distal portion of these fimbriae have mannose receptors. So blocking this receptor with D-mannose or the proanthocyanidins from cranberry really decreases the capacity for binding and colonization. So you may offer cranberry use for UTI prophylaxis in contemporary formulations that have 36 milligrams of bioavailable proanthocyanidins for prophylaxis. You may offer methenamine hippurate for prophylaxis. It cleaves into a bacteriostatic agent, formaldehyde and ammonia. And this is done in an acidic environment. So this is why we give vitamin C. And so generally, it is another type of agent to decrease bacterial load within the bladder. There are several other agents that were identified in common use that didn't have very robust data sets behind it. But in general, sometimes they do work for patients regardless. And I would just strongly suggest that we look at other alternative strategies before we move to antibiotics. There's also very strong data that in perimenopausal and postmenopausal women with recurrent UTI, low-dose vaginal estrogen reduces the risk of future urinary tract infection, particularly in women that are diagnosed with genitourinary syndrome of menopause.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. What exactly is genitourinary syndrome of menopause?
Great question. Genitourinary syndrome of menopause, and I'm just going to refer to it as GSM, is an exceptionally prevalent condition, and it is a spectrum of symptoms, physical changes that result from declining estrogen and androgen concentrations in the genitourinary tract during the menopausal transition. Now, the clinical symptoms of GSM that involve the genital tract include like vulvar, vestibular, and vaginal dryness, irritation, discomfort and burning, stenosis causing dyspareunia or pain with intercourse, spontaneous bleeding, fissuring, and there's a lot of secondary sexual dysfunction that's also associated with GSM, decreased libido, arousal, sensation, orgasmic response. And there's clinical symptoms that involve the lower urinary tract. It is the genitourinary syndrome. So it can develop into urgency, frequency, nocturia, dysuria, stress incontinence, urgency incontinence, and most importantly, recurrent urinary tract infections. Screening patients, they should really be queried about all these types of bothersome symptoms of GSM, including that patient that you spoke about at the very beginning, the older woman who comes in. You know, is she having other urinary symptoms? Is she sexually active and having pain with sex? You know, and it may actually be a consensus that these all types of genitourinary conditions that we're discussing, you know, are part of a spectrum that is linked together. And it can make, in some instances, identification and evaluation and treatment rather complex. But also, let me add that it's not confined to peri and postmenopausal older women. It applies to any woman on systemic estrogen, women who are on aromatase inhibitors and a selective estrogen receptor modulators for treatment of breast cancer are in a profound estrogen deficient state, breastfeeding women, women undergoing other cancer treatment, women on oral contraceptives, women after any type of surgical oophorectomy. So there is an enormous number of women who may have GSM that don't fit our typical phenotype of the older woman who is postmenopausal.
Now, what is it specifically about GSM that makes women more susceptible to UTIs?
As I alluded to before, there's a lot of physical changes associated with GSM that include atrophy of the labia, reduced moisture in the vagina, introital stenosis, clitoral atrophy, but the vaginal surface can become very friable. It becomes hypopigmented. It gets petechiae, ulcerations, tears. The urethra may have caruncles, prolapse, polyps. And all these things don't always directly correlate with UTIs and even with GSM symptoms. We do have some objective measures too, like vaginal pH and a vaginal maturation index that shows that the cellular type in the vagina actually shifts as this epithelium thins and as the vaginal pH rises. But the thing that happens when you lose estrogen is as that pH changes and these cells start to exfoliate and break down, what actually happening is that you're losing commensal bacterial organisms called lactobacilli that are common constituents in an estrogenized vagina. So they may be the cause of many of these symptoms is simply the loss of our symbionts that will then not be protective against some of these bacterial pathogens that now have an opportunity to overgrow and gain access to the urinary tract.
So I think I'm getting a sense of what the answer to this one's going to be, but tell me just kind of to finish it up. So why is vaginal estrogen so important for UTI prevention and vaginal health?
Yeah, vaginal estrogen will actually reverse many of these aforementioned changes in the vaginal epithelium, such as thinning, reduced moisture, atrophy. It really replenishes the pH balance and the natural flora of the vagina and reduces the cellular turnover. So our guidelines do very clearly state the genitourinary syndrome of menopause, AUA guidelines, that clinicians should offer local low-dose vaginal estrogen to patients with GSM to improve all the symptoms and to decrease the risk of recurrent urinary tract infections. We have to regain that symbiosis. It's a key component of understanding the etiology and transmission of uropathogens. The ultimate goal is really reestablishing harmony in the vagina with our commensal organisms and preventing collateral damage from our antimicrobial overutilization.
Well, thank you so much. That was an absolutely wonderful exploration of the urobiome and non-antibiotic prophylaxis. And just again, to stress the importance of vaginal estrogen in women that are not just older and perimenopausal or postmenopausal, but also any women suffering from a loss of hormones that might end up causing that same sort of hypoestrogenic state. So thank you so much. Today, we've talked with Dr. Melissa Kaufman about the diagnosis and management of recurrent UTI and the influence of GSM. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please take a moment to download the Medscape app to listen and subscribe to this podcast series on urinary tract infections. This is Anne Lenore Ackerman for Medscape in Discussion Urinary Tract Infection Podcast.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Urinary Tract Infection Podcast series with our host, Dr. Lenore Ackerman. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on urinary tract infections.